Ahmad Al-Basha, Yemen Embassy. You said, sir, Mr. Robert, that you don't want Obama to be drilling in dry wells. Could you expand on that and tell us what are the dry wells you were talking about?
Look, the basic point I was just trying to make is you can't do everything at once. You certainly can't do everything at once when at a moment when your national priority is not foreign at all. And so there's a need to prioritize, and there's a need to be very vigilant about maintaining those priorities while, of course, keeping your eye open to opportunities. That's not an easy balance to do. I think Patrick did a very good job of explaining the pitfalls of the slightest error in how one would engage with Iran. And so, I mean, I don't want to suggest that that's a dry well, but I think that the slightest error actually triggers a much larger repercussion, which I think is what Patrick's point was. And so that's very, very, very difficult to do. And so there is one area where I would put a major caution. Yellow flag, not red flag. Yes.
My name is Amal Mudallali. I work for Mr. Hariri of Lebanon. My question is, what kind of a Lebanon policy would you see a Obama administration has? And with the talk about engagement with Syria, how would this affect, you think, the policy in Lebanon? And can you see a closeness towards Lebanon and the democracy movement as we've seen in the Bush administration? Thank you.
This is a very complicated question. I'm not going to go into any great detail. I think you've obviously pointed at a huge question mark. How do you engage Syria? Can you engage Syria? Can you pursue a possible Israel-Syria arrangement that doesn't undermine or exacerbate the situation in Lebanon? I think the answer, at least in theory, is yes. And it really depends, at least one aspect of this depends on how the Syrians approach their engagement with the United States. If we're talking about a potential peace agreement that does have all the implications that people are looking for, namely the severing of the Syrian relationship with Iran. Severing might be too strong a word, but the detachment of Syria from this nexus that begins in the Bekaa Valley and ends in Tehran, then one could see an Israel-Syria agreement that theoretically bolsters the anti-Hezbollah forces in Lebanon. That's not an impossibility. If that's the direction in which this discussion is heading, then I think it certainly needs to be explored, and it's a win-win for many different parties. If, however, we are talking about a zero sum, where Syria gains but our partners in Lebanon lose, then it's a much more difficult engagement to pursue, and something that I think people will take a step back before they jump in. Steve Rosen, and don't forget my colleagues here.
I have a question for Patrick to ask you to make a prediction, starting with a fact. In July, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Bill Burns, met with the Iranians as part of a delegation. So if that's all the incoming Obama team does, it wouldn't be something new. My question is, what do they have available to them to do new, to send a message of change, at least vis-a-vis Iran, that doesn't cross these red lines that you have painted? Is it to send the secretary or the deputy secretary, who are the only officials higher than the undersecretary? Is it to escalate the level on the Iranian side? But of course, that's up to the Iranians. Is it to change the terms of engagement? For example, no longer to demand the suspension of enrichment as a condition for further steps. Which is the part that is available to them to do new, since they claim there was something that wasn't done? Mm.
Well, the main purpose of all this effort is to show the world that you're being reasonable. And therefore, the main thing that you have to do is make a big squawk. So perhaps what you're doing is just simply taking all the things that you've had for the last 10 years that you've been doing and prepared to do and offered to do, and put them together in one great big huge presidential speech. But that's a big squawk. Because you list for people this real long catalog of all the stuff that you got out there. The main purpose of this is not to come up with a package that's really going to finally lead the Iranians to sign on the dotted line. Because frankly, that's overly optimistic. The main purpose of this is to show the world and to show the Iranian public that what you're doing is reasonable. Because if, in fact, you make that big squawk, it makes it more likely that the Iranians will finally follow through and accept some of the offers that you've had out there for a long time. Because while we've been doing this in small piecemeal steps, we got nothing. So, for instance, it was a huge internal debate inside the administration before the Bush team agreed to lift the de facto veto on Iran's application to the World Trade Organization and to sell Iran spare parts for their Boeing airplanes. Once the U.S. decided that it was going to lift its veto on Iran's long-standing application to the World Trade Organization, Iran lost interest, and despite repeated requests in the World Trade Organization, has refused to send the facts saying they'd like to start the process and all they have to do is send the facts, and they refused to do it. And once the United States said Boeing can sell those parts to Iran, issued the license right away, and Boeing was excited, and Boeing keeps pestering the Iranians with emails and faxes and has gotten no response. What we got to do is figure out a way to show the world that we're doing a heck of a lot to try and engage the Iranians. That's the issue here. It's not what's finally going to persuade the Iranians to take up our offer. And you're right. We've got a bunch of things we've done. We never put it all together in one great big huge package that the Secretary, or even better, the President, has announced. And I'd throw in a bunch of new stuff, too. I'd figure out a bunch of new stuff to put in there. All right? And I would throw in everything and the kitchen sink.
Michelle Kelman, then Bob Friedman.
Thank you. Michelle Kelman with National Public Radio. If you were writing the briefing book for the president or the next secretary of state, what's your headline about this is the key issue, a key issue? And Patrick, you also didn't mention that
there's elections in Iran next year, and I wonder if that
factors into sort of the pitfalls.
Well, my headline in the briefing book with the president would be, "Sir, you may not want to do the Middle East, but the Middle East will do you." And so, therefore, don't just go off and do Afghanistan, Pakistan. I think the main task we're going to face is persuading this team, as Rob was describing that some time back, the main task we're going to face is persuading this team, you got to do the Middle East when all the problems we're talking about offer little chance of success, lots of problems, and lots of hard work. I mean, that's supposed to entice the president to get involved? On the Iranian elections, I don't think that we should hold off on an offer about towards Iran while we wait for the Iranian elections. Because what's that suggesting? That if after Ahmadinejad gets reelected, then we give him a prize? Well, I don't think so. And if somebody presents himself as a moderate gets reelected, then we're supposed to be nice to him? No, I'd rather put on an offer on, I mean, let's face it, the moderates that we're talking about running in Iran, most of them are people who, instead of the Ahmadinejad spit-in-your-eye approach, their approach is blow smoke in your eye. So I would rather put together an offer which we can make from day one, which combines carrots and sticks, which says to the Iranians, if you don't accept this, you're going to be worse off in the future. I think the basic problem we face is the dynamic where the hardliners in Iran can reasonably claim the longer they wait, the better off they are. And I think we've got to start reversing that right away.
David?
Michelle, where's Michelle? There she is. I think it's engagement without illusions. If you succeed, great. But a preventive strategy that could avoid the slide to radicalization is important as well. And I agree completely with Patrick. Those of you who think that if you don't focus on it, if no one in your administration who's senior focuses on it, therefore the problems aren't going to give the United States headache and heartache in the coming 4 years. I think you don't see it as a dynamic process, but I don't think this means, again, I'll repeat what I said before, that the president should be a desk officer on all these issues. I think there's a way to walk and chew gum at the same time, and there's enough talented people at the senior level that can help the president with this burden.
I'll just add my own headline, which would be, differentiate between those issues where the key missing ingredient is American leadership. American leadership can contribute to all sorts of issues, but it's not necessarily the key missing ingredient in lots of issues. I, for example, don't think that American leadership is the key missing ingredient to success in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. It is essential, but it is not the key missing ingredient. I think it is perhaps the key missing ingredient in stopping Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. So I think differentiating where we are the key missing ingredient is essential for a new president. Robert Friedman.
Yeah, Robert Friedman, Johns Hopkins University. Just two very quick points. To Patrick, we had one more engagement of sorts with the Iranians, and that was Mrs. Albright, if you remember, speeches. And, well, I don't know if that backfired in our faces. It seems more the hardliners overrode it, but if you could speak to that. And then, David, got to get you involved here. Settlement outpost issue. This would strike me as now the Israelis themselves are waking up to the cancer in their midst, so to speak, with the settlements. This might be a useful initiative for our friend Obama, maybe pushing the Israelis to do what most want to do anyway. So if you could comment on that.
The Albright initiatives towards Iran kept thinking that if only we found the magic formula of just the right words, that then we could make this great breakthrough with the Iranians and make progress. And this is nicely described by Ken Pollack in his book. And as Ken comes to the conclusion, I think quite correctly, that that was wrong. I think the objective was wrong. The purpose of these initiatives is not to reach the magic agreement with the Iranians. The purpose of these initiatives is to construct a situation where the world thinks that we're making a really good offer to the Iranians. I think that's the only circumstance under which Iran's going to take the offer, because Iran is so suspicious, the Supreme Leader is so suspicious of us, he thinks any pill that we, anything that we offer, any carrot we offer is poison, so that only if there is a broad international agreement that the Americans are making a reasonable offer to the Iranians, and there's a broad international agreement that if the Iranians don't take it, then bad things are going to happen to them. That's really the only circumstances under which I can see the Iranians taking this. And therefore, our principal target with these offers is not Iran. Our principal target with these offers is, in fact, American public opinion, world public opinion. And that's what offers the best prospect that we're going to succeed in these offers with Iran. So instead of spending hours trying to parse out whether or not adding pistachios to the rugs on the things that can be exported from Iran to the United States, the heck with all that. Figure out what's going to play well, and I think that with the world opinion, and there my main advice is make it spectacular.
David, as you answer Bob, can you also take the moment to give us your 30-second prognostication on February 10th?
All right, I'll try. Look, on the my sense is whatever Israel's going to do on the outpost is not going to be considered big enough, frankly, to make a big impression, because I think the settlers feel they have a deal with Ehud Barak that goes like this. They'll move these outposts from what's called private land to state land. Now, what do you define as state land is a huge issue, because Barak doesn't feel that Israelis can, the defense ministry or the IDF can go to the Israeli Supreme Court and defend building on private land. But to move it just to state land, that would expand existing settlements or even create new ones, frankly, on other state land will not be seen by many people as that was big. Therefore, in my view, since I think even settlers, believe it or not, see an advantage to a delineation of borders, because right now they feel they're being throttled everywhere. They can't build even in the blocks. That a differentiated approach that says whatever this 5% is that they can build there, that is called Israel. Begin never annexed one settler. If they could get a deal that would enable 200 out of 268,000 to be annexed, that maybe they would pro forma be against it, but most Israelis would be for it. And given that the land differences in the West Bank, I'm not talking about Jerusalem, I'm not talking about refugees, are minuscule, in my view, that is a huge deal. And that, in my view, only American leadership can achieve. That is the missing piece, so to speak, of that a part of it. I don't think necessarily you can solve everything tomorrow, as I keep saying. But you can lower a lot of the suspicion and mistrust, and give the moderates an achievement, and finally give Israel the borders it deserves so it can build and not be frozen everywhere, which is in many ways what the settlers certainly feel today. On the election itself, it seems, look, the people that are the big enigma for me, and they never seem to reassess the strategy, is the Israeli Arabs. And if I didn't know better, I would think each one of them is being paid by the Likud. Because time and time again, like Lucy in the football, they vote for the same parties that are not coalitionable in an Israeli context. Now, you might say it's utterly unfair that if when these big issues come up, they should be coalitionable. But where the Israeli public, Jewish public is they want what they call a Jewish majority on these issues. So by them voting for the Israeli Arabs, in my view, it means that all the center-left in Israel, it takes 10 seats and just throws them out the window. The Likud has got to keep applauding the Israeli Arabs. Every single day, keep doing what you're doing. You never reassess your strategy. Keep going. And I think that I could get into all the dynamics of Barak, Livni, and Netanyahu will take me longer than Rob gave me, so I'll have to stop here.
Yes, Maury.
Maury Amate, a veteran pessimist. Rob, you mentioned that perhaps because Obama is so new and so much promise that you could bring about he could bring about a historic Arab acceptance of Israel, based psychological and emotional. I think the only thing close to that, of course, you'd agree, was Sadat going to Jerusalem. But the foundation for that agreement was the demilitarized Sinai, 17,000 square miles of desert between them. So you had the security concept. David, on the other hand, spoke about giving Israel 5% of the West Bank in any settlement, and that would be a guarantee against Qassams. Isn't that
No, that's not what I said, sir. I said, if I could just be clarified, I said that I think that the IDF will have to stay for a while, and that I don't think the PA wants the IDF to leave so soon. And as long, because of the Gaza-Qassam experience, I think the IDF is going to have to stay.
Okay, I must have missed that. But as long as they have some security control over the area, yeah. Of course, you know, a little bit of territory doesn't give you much security.
Not hearing a question, I'll move to the next. Yes.
Alan Brown at the Canadian Embassy. A question for David, I guess. First, about the special envoy, do you think that any appointment of an envoy would await the Israeli elections, or would there be work for an envoy to do in advance of that? And secondly, assuming that Livni is able to form a government after the elections, what major changes would you see in the approach of the administration to, say, the Annapolis process that's winding sort of down?
Good question. It would seem to me that the key issue on the envoy is going to be who's the Secretary of State. And it gets back to Rob's like earlier remarks, namely, Clinton worked with the envoy system. Obama has gone on record saying that he wants the same thing. You could say, but between July and November, it's a long way. I don't know, but I'm saying what he said on the record. I think the Secretary of State and the President-elect have to have a discussion and see how they see that. I mean, it seems to me you've got four separate Middle East negotiations. You've got potentially you know, certainly an Israeli-Palestinian one. You have the issue of, it could be, with an Israeli-Syrian one. You have the issue of Iranian negotiations, and you have the issue of Iraq. It seems to me Petraeus and Crocker were a great team. I don't know how that's going to work now, you know, in the future. But those are four sets of issues that you would need a Secretary of State and a President to have an understanding. Do you want a super envoy to deal, manage four sets of negotiations? Or do you want to say, no, maybe not all four, maybe less than four, or at all? Or do you work it just through the Assistant Secretary system, you know, as it was worked in the Bush administration with David Welch? So I think that's, to me, that's the determinative discussion is the President and the Secretary of State. Now, on the second set of issues that you raise about how would Livni do different than Annapolis, I think it'll be a question of her coalition, frankly. And if, you know, if Shas is the key factor again, you know, they might feel certain issues she can't fully discuss. It will be interesting what happens between now and the elections. What does Condoleezza Rice do? Everyone looks at this as like a dead time. There's going to be a Sharm el-Sheikh meeting on Sunday. It's reasonable to assume, and I don't know if I put money on it, then someone will try to collect, but I tend to believe that, and especially in the Israeli election season, if I had to bet money, I would say the following is going to happen. Both Livni and the Palestinians are supposed to put forward where they see progress has been made. And each side is going to want to insulate themselves in such a way that they don't expose their own concessions. They're happy to expose the concessions of the other, by the way. They have no problem with that. But they don't want to expose their own. And so, therefore, I assume whatever they say, the quartet, or at least that comes out publicly, will be of a very vague and general diluted character. Now, what does Rice do? Does Rice believe that if they're not going to do it, then I'm going to give a speech in Washington, or I'll ask President Bush, you know, to give a speech to summarize where are we a year after Annapolis? We said we wanted to have, you know, a breakthrough by now. And she'll use that as a way, maybe, perhaps, we don't know, to say, well, this is, the parties won't say where they've been, well, I'll say it. And it'll be interesting. I think if this was not an election season, I would not rule out, I can't say I know, I don't, I would not rule out a situation where Livni might even ask Rice to say certain things that makes it easier for an administration on its way out the door that's considered friendly to Israel than for a new administration to get its footing. But given that Livni is in an election season, anything that Rice would say, it's very easy that Livni would interpret that as cramping her style and kind of nudging her a little bit more to the left than she would want to position herself with a lot of ex-Likud voters who make up a bulk of Kadima. So I tend to think that that back channel of Livni Rice, if there was going to be that back channel in this twilight zone of American politics, I don't think it'll materialize given that Israel's facing an election.
Just one last sentence to close, and I apologize. I see at least four people wanted to ask more questions, only because we didn't mention it. And David very correctly referred to these series of negotiations that will be going on. There's at least one more tacit negotiation that may be going on, that perhaps there are others, and that has to do with energy. We don't talk about it as much when oil is $60 a barrel as we did when it was $120 a barrel. But while everything is going on in the Middle East, at least President-elect Obama is on record as initiating an energy strategy, which the basic idea would be to decrease the amount of revenue that major Middle East players get from the United States. And so that will be the backdrop, if we go through with this, the backdrop for all these negotiations that were going on, and it's anybody's guess as to precisely how these players in the Middle East will react to efforts by the United States to, over time, decrease their principal sources of revenue. It will have an impact, so we need to put that one into the mix as well.